This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You've done it again. You've put on the West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Today, we're talking about Season 5, Episode 8, Shutdown, or How Josiah Got His Groove Back.
It was written by Mark Goffman, a terrific fellow, very talented writer, would later become exec producer of Sleepy Hollow, Bull, White Collar, and other great shows. This episode was directed by Christopher Misiano, and it first aired on November 19th, 2003.
Coming up later, we'll be joined once again by Gene Sperling. He's the former director of the National Economic Council. How Stella Got Her Groove Back, by the way, was directed by Kevin Rodney Sullivan, who directed the West Wing episode Lord John Marbury.
Boom.
And of course, it co-starred Taye Diggs.
Right.
The world of the West Wing is so expansive, and there's so many people who have been involved over the various seasons that really, I feel like you can look up any big title, movie or TV, and find some connection to the West Wing.
How far removed from Kevin Bacon is it?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, not very far removed. We can get to Kevin Bacon in, you know, zero steps.
There you go. That's all you really need. Well, one step. Zero steps would be Kevin Bacon on the West Wing.
Sure. Okay. In one step. Yes. I was thinking while I was watching, I was like, this episode is How Josiah Got His Groove Back. And then I just went and Googled How Stella Got Her Groove Back, West Wing. And immediately, first result, Kevin Rodney Sullivan, director of Lord John Marbury.
There it is.
This is a fun game, actually. Pick something else. Give me another something from the 2000s.
Something from the 2000s?
Or late 90s or whatever.
A piece of work? Heathers?
Heathers is not from the 2000s.
Well, isn't it 90s?
That's fine. I'll just do it without even looking it up.
Christian Slater.
Has Christian Slater in it.
Yeah, I know. That was terrible. I answered it as I said it. That failed on every level.
No, Heathers is from the 80s.
I'm 52. Everything's from whatever.
All right. Well, that's a good note to end this part of the discussion on. Everything is from whatever. Here's what the whatever is on Shutdown. I'm going to read the Warner Brothers synopsis because it's pretty good. A disastrous financial crisis looms when the federal government is shut down after the president engages in a war of wills between the powerful GOP House Speaker over an extra 2% in budget reductions that would trim many of Bartlett's key social programs, and the Democrats are blamed because of opinion polls. That's a long sentence.
You'd think I would have played a larger role in a war of wills.
Continuing. As Leo, Josh, and Toby send everyone home, they remain uneasy as the president refuses to compromise until he arrives on a bold plan to personally and publicly challenge the Republicans in the halls of the Capitol. Meanwhile, Abby suddenly reappears from her self-imposed exile for a state dinner that she might have to cook herself.
Oh, I can't wait to see that fucking scene!
This episode starts immediately on the heels of the previous episode. In fact, there's even a little bit of an overlap. We get the end of the episode
just like we
again.
Just had.
Hmm?
I'm trying to create an overlap every time you speak. As a sort of really annoying recurring joke.
Okay.
I thought. Yeah.
It actually.
I thought that you would like it. If I didn't. All right. That's the final. I promise that's the final one. The real Josh Molina would now do this for the next hour until it became an actual fight. And you're like, dude, I've got stuff to do today, but I'm going to suck it up.
Okay. All right. Well, then you tell me what you think about the teaser.
Ah, nice. Well done. I'm not going to give it to you, but that was a good effort.
Okay. No, really, what did you think?
Really now? Okay. Last episode ended with a fairly good cliffhanger. Imminent shutdown, a call of a big bluff, or not, we don't know if it's a bluff, but, you know, Bartlett essentially saying, fine, shut it down.
President, shut it down.
Right. And we launch into what I find to be a not super credible scenario and the cold open, and indeed throughout much of the episode, which is that on the heels of this momentous decision on the part of the president, he washes his hands of any further involvement.
Damn, I probably missed the first half.
Sorry?
Providence is going to get a whooping from my fighting Irish.
I don't really... It's kind of stylish, the cold open, but I don't really buy it that he wouldn't even chat with Leo. I mean, this is a huge discussion that now has to happen, and the president is just going to check out. I'll be watching basketball, as if there's nothing further to discuss. There's no strategy to devise. There's no briefing of his staff and Leo as to what his thinking is. He's just out of there. I'm going to go eat nuts and watch my team.
Charlie says, is he coming back? And I... And now I'm just imagining that's a series wrap for Martin Sheen.
That's funny. He's not coming back. It's just us now.
Stuck with this hand that he's given us. And then Leo ends the teaser. Toby asks, now what? And Leo says,
we shut it down.
And once again, we get the very dramatic drum hits that we had at the end of the last episode. But the end of the last episode was an actual cliffhanger. Here he's just repeating information that we already know.
And not only do we already know, but even the characters who just said what happened, they know the answer. It's not even news to them, so we can't even try to vicariously enjoy the bomb swell through them. I find this to be a bomb splat.
Triple bomb splat.
A pretty big one.
Punctuated by the triple drum hit.
Right.
That didn't totally land. And as far as the president's escape to watch the Notre Dame game, I felt like it was just a way to set up so many basketball metaphors and really sports metaphors. It's crazy to think that Aaron Sorkin wasn't involved in this episode because it is sports metaphors it's basketball and poker metaphors throughout the entire thing.
Right. I'm going to object to an early poker reference as well.
I was wondering. There is a comment from Josh. He's talking about pro poker players in Atlantic City. And he says,
you remember when I went to Atlantic City and I came back complaining that all the pro poker players suck all the fun out of the game? Those guys, they bet the bank when they have a good hand. And you either fold or you go in all the way with them.
I wrote it down as a question to ask you.
Yes, well, I wrote down, boy, do I want to play poker with Josh Lyman.
So can you unpack what he's trying to say or what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's trying to say these guys, when they feel they have leverage, when they have the winning hand, they really go for it. We're playing, you know, this is all in poker. But of course, bet sizing is a very important element of playing poker at a high level. And if you simply bet everything you had only when you had a great hand, everyone would know you had a great hand and they would fold to you. So, you know, there's something called value betting, which is based on either the knowledge or the supposition that you have a winning hand, you bet for value, trying to get inferior hands to call you. It's, you know, it's a very surface level conception of poker that
if
you have a good hand, you bet everything. And if you have a terrible hand, you always fold. There are players who are like that. They're called nits. They play very, very tightly and they tend not to get paid off when they have a good hand because, you know, that guy only bets when he's really got the nuts. So it's, now there's nothing wrong with having a character reveal himself to know nothing about poker, but I think the moment is not conceptualized that way. We're supposed to kind of be impressed with, I think the guy, the veteran, the wily fox, Josh Lyman, is, explaining to a neophyte how it works.
Yeah.
So that one fell short for me.
He's Lyman-splaining, and really, we Jonathan tells us he only played one hand in Atlantic City.
Yeah, right. Well, then again, yeah, maybe he's just simply making that classic mistake of extrapolating from a very, very small pool of data and creating a greater portrayal of something about which he doesn't know enough.
Yeah, exactly. For the first time ever, Josh has decided to form an opinion based on very little experience or understanding.
Right.
And then tell Donna. Again, there's another purpose to the poker metaphor here, more than just revealing how little Josh knows about poker strategy. He says, I think the president stays in. And I think really when he says, either you fold or you go in all the way with them, he's just giving us an early look about the division within the senior staff, that he's talking about the rest of the staff when he's talking about people folding, and then going in all the way with him is himself. He's ready to go in all the way with the president.
Right.
Which won't pay off till much later. Or pay out, I guess, is the poker term.
Well, I mean, this is what I find lacks credibility sort of overall about this episode, is the idea that Bartlett wouldn't even share his thinking with the rest of the staff for most of the episode. They're kind of trying to vamp and buy time, trying to figure out what they should do, but they can't even consult the president. It's just a weird, I don't know, I feel like this episode has a framework that could have made for a wonderful and compelling episode and great storyline, but it somehow lacks the sophistication of the earlier iteration of The West Wing. And this is the first time I really felt it very tangibly throughout an episode.
Well, that's interesting, because did you feel that way when the president had his hot mic moment?
Yeah, I think we might be talking about a .22 caliber mine in a .357 Magnum world.
I thought of that episode a few times here, because again, he had a strategy there and he let it play out and he never let anyone know. He never said, I did that on purpose and I wanted to see, you know, that was going to jumpstart things in the way that I wanted, until, you know, CJ in the end susses it out, much like she does in this episode. And it's a stratagem, but it's not.
That's an interesting parallel. And I would have to say that I didn't feel that way about the first episode to which you refer. And I'm trying to figure out why. It's hard for me to reverse engineer in my own mind. My guess is it played out somehow more cleverly in that episode. I mean, in this episode, they are... Well, I guess my take on this episode is that it's not that President Bartlett had a stratagem that was just so fiendishly clever that it was bound to work. My impression watching is that ultimately it was the walk to Capitol Hill and then the decision to walk out.
Right.
And, you know, it was optics, but not right. Optics that Bartlett could have known about in the Roosevelt room when he said, no 3%. So,
and they're not even ones that he came up with. Those were Josh's ideas.
Right, exactly. And again, I think there's also those moments, that moment, the way it was handled to me also had a certain lack of sophistication. I don't know why. I kind of started to get me back on its side this episode when President Bartlett got out to speak to some tourists who may be disappointed that certain museums or whatever musea are shut down, and then decides to make the walk to Capitol Hill. That seems like a good decision on the fly. And then the decision to leave. But why have that moment where we, the audience, see Josh Lyman say,
let's go right now?
I think we're going from a West Wing that I always lauded for being one step ahead of the audience to an episode where frequently the audience is two steps ahead of the show. Why spoon feed that to us? Why not have Halfley in the office saying, no, we're not going out there. We'll keep him waiting. Let's get on the same page here, and us start to believe that President Bartlett's sitting there like a turkey losing the optic war, and then just have them go out when they're finally ready, the Republicans, and realize that Bartlett's gone, or maybe still catch them walking out. But why telegraph that moment to us?
Yeah, I mean, I think I understand why you would want that, the more dramatic unfolding of that moment. But I think the reason why we saw it is because this is not just an episode about the president getting his groove back. It's about Josh getting his groove back. And they wanted to show us that Josh's ideas aren't limited just to, one, sticking behind the president, and two, walking to the... He executed the entire play. He called it. I think, again, it's paying off this basketball metaphor.
They've got a 7-foot center and the best power forward in the game. Why zone?
Like, why play zone defense? And I think this is a, you know, he's yelling at the coach, and here Josh gets to be the coach and really see the whole board.
I definitely thought of that element as I watched it, but I'm quite sure, I can even think of a couple approaches. There would have either been a way to pay off after the moment that Josh had conceptualized the walkout, or even we could have had, and I think this is what would have happened in the first four seasons of the show, we would have seen a look in Josh's eye that tells us
it was his idea.
He's got, you know, before it happens, something.
Oh, I see.
You know, yeah. Bartlett would look stricken and Josh would say, hang on, I got an idea. Even, you know, that's the bad version, but it would be something like that. It would be a line, a better line than that, but something that says, hang on, wait a minute, I got an idea, or a look in his eye. Then we'd cut to Halfley's room. Then they'd come out and we'd realize that Josh's idea was like, let's not wait for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I could even imagine.
Better version.
I could even imagine even seeing what we see, which is Josh sitting down next to the president and whispering something into his ear without actually hearing what it is that he says.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's, I think, how it could have and would have been handled better previously.
I was swept away in it.
Oh, that's good.
I dug it, yeah.
Then again, you're an enormous fan of the post-Sorkin years.
Right. I was so caught up in the plot. And also, just really, I do love the episodes when characters make a comeback. I think I was a bit of a sucker for this one. Here we've got both the president and Josh figuring it out. And I love that. I love when CJ, you know, comes back. Oliver Babish says to her,
I was going to say you took a beating the last few months.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you were trying to get back in the game with one swing.
Is that what you were wondering?
Yeah.
Those moments and like Sam, you know, being a blood enemy to Kevin Conn. I and sending the motorcade down the thing to, you know, I love all these moments when people come back. So I dug it.
Well, interesting, actually. I think what you're saying speaks to, I think, an attempt that was less successful for me than for you, but an attempt on the part now of Wells and company to create Aaron-like moments mm-hmm. of redemption. To me, I was more struck by the attempt and I felt like they fell short. Mm. But it is, I can see why it would appeal to somebody who's a hardcore fan of Aaron's version of the West Wing. That's actually intriguing.
I remember in an interview that I saw with John Wells at one point, I think he said that in season 5, the writers were kind of a cover band, an Aaron Sorkin cover band. And I haven't really felt that so much in the previous episodes because the doldrums of those episodes were so different from Sorkin years. But then this episode does have so many callbacks and so many things that are of the same texture as those episodes. This is the first time when I feel like, okay, the cover band thing makes sense here. You know, you're playing all the right notes, even ending the episode with the president saying, what's next?
It's
like, this is what a West Wing episode is supposed to look and feel like.
Huh. So I feel like we're just having different reactions to the same phenomenon.
I mean, I think two people can see a cover band play and one person can be like, well, it's not the band, you know, it's not, these aren't the guys who created this music. And then another person can just be like, I love this song.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fair enough. Fair enough. To me, it pointed out contrast.
And I don't disagree with you at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote down the phrase schoolhouse rock more than once in this episode.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol Hill. Well,
I felt just a little bit, things were being too spoon-fed to me. By the way, huge fan of Schoolhouse Rock. But now that I'm 52, I enjoy them for nostalgia's sake rather than to learn from them. And one bit of dialogue and interchange that I wrote down was Roy saying,
they caved, we won. How much more leverage do we need before we start governing again?
We are governing. We're slowing the rate of federal spending increases. We're stopping this president from driving the country deeper into debt and leaving our children to pay for it. We're doing what we told the voters we would do if they elected us.
It just didn't sound to me like what Aaron would have had these guys say. Mm-hmm. I prefer to be struggling to keep up with what these guys are discussing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By the way, in terms of the federal spending, at one point CJ asks, you know, what are the actual numbers? And one of the reporters asks, you know, what's 1%? And she gives an answer. She kind of deflects without knowing what the actual numbers are. And what do I know, really? I'm not entirely sure. But in 2003, when this episode aired, the federal budget's expenditures for that year was $2.13 trillion. So just 1% is $21.3 billion.
Hmm. Well, you're forgetting the beauty of the federal budget process.
What's that?
No one understands it.
Yeah. I'm sure I'm getting something wrong here, but let me interrupt your gripe fest a little bit with a discussion about Josh's arc in this episode, which I really like. The laptop scene with Josh and Donna is really funny, I thought.
Okay, take my laptop. Start a tally of programs affected by the shutdown and email it to me as you go. And don't read anything in the folder marked private. Don't take my laptop.
I like it too.
Don't look in the folder called private. Yeah. Don't take my laptop.
Yeah, I like that.
I also love that the conversation continues and then the scene ends and Josh leaves and then Donna leaves. But this is a great detail. Right before, as she's leaving, Donna casts like one uneasy glance in the direction of the laptop, which is off camera. Like she's still thinking and possibly worried about what might be in that folder.
Yeah.
It's a tiny moment, but it's a great nonverbal button for that scene.
Yes. What is the moment when Donna says, seriously?
When Josh tells her that she has to go home, that when Leo said, everyone below special assistant has to go home, it includes her.
Janelle's reaction is priceless to me. There's something, there's just about 9 different emotions that are going on. She's bemused. She's a little bit amused. There's the connection to Josh and she's going to really have to go. There's just, there's so much going on. It's so rich in a single word and response that.
Seriously?
Yeah, I really felt for Donna's loyalty here and her sense of commitment. And I think they do a good job of making that more painful, more tough to accept. You know, we feel Donna's disbelief here by having this character, Rena, in the episode.
Yes.
Who was strange. I actually had to spoil some stuff for myself a little bit because I couldn't understand what the character was doing.
You wanted to check to see whether she was coming back?
Yeah, I had to look to see if there were more episodes, and I was, temporarily relieved to find out, yes, this character does come back. I mean, it was a mixed feeling because I'm not sure that I really care for the character.
Well, there's also this, I noticed some very pre-Me Too camera work. I mean, the framing of her breasts and her rear are just sort of weirdly these lascivious lingering shots. I'm like, dude. And then you have Toby say,
a walking lawsuit.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, why exactly? I'm not even sure what value that was supposed to bring
exactly
to the episode.
Yeah. And then I was wondering, like, what was actually happening with this character who says, oh, I compile clippings over at Energy. I was like, is this a spy? Has someone infiltrated the West Wing?
A spy? Yeah.
Or maybe like they were all hallucinating or it was a ghost who was wandering the halls teaching people lessons about cleaning up after themselves.
That's pretty funny. Yeah. And then there is, by the way, I meant it when I said that I think Mark Goffman is a terrific writer and now then complaining about this entire episode. And it's more to me in the conception and framing of it, which I think is probably a group responsibility rather than Mark's dialogue, which I think is very good. But there is, we get that scene at the end, the person who's cleaning up, who actually knows quite a bit more than we would have given her credit for.
It's the cover
about
band.
What's going on at the upper levels of government. Yes. It's just sort of, we had a little taste of that, right? From Aaron with, who was the, like, Sam assistant woman?
The girl from the Ashley Olsen thing.
Right.
Genuflect when you say that, mister. Oh, remember, it's Winifred Hooper.
Oh, very good. How can you forget a name like Winifred Hooper?
Right.
Right.
Yeah, Rena is a little bit of a...
Winifred Redux?
Winifred Hooper Redux, yeah. But I would really like to encourage everyone to watch this episode if they rewatch this episode with the idea that this is a ghost. it's like the Sixth Sense, and we've never noticed Rena before because the halls are usually too packed with people.
Although I have seen old paper plates and cups fly through the air into the dumpster. Right, exactly. It always struck me as odd.
Yeah.
Well, maybe in future episodes, we'll see what they were setting up, however clumsily, in this episode.
I suspect we will. Josh then goes into the war room in this sort of deserted West Wing. They're going to try and figure out what they're going to do. And Josh speaks up on behalf of the president. He says,
we have to call Halfley out for what he is really doing. It's a coup. He's trying to defund every Bartlett initiative we've passed in the last 2 years.
Again, it's pretty literal and on the nose what he's actually saying, but the dramatic point of it is he's the only one in the room who's standing up for the president. Everyone else is reacting to this like they're in crisis mode where they have to figure out what they have to give into, how they're going to be able to appease Halfley, what they can get the president to swallow.
Sign off on.
Yeah. And he comes in on the other side and he gets sent out of the room by Leo because Leo, Angela, and Toby are the ones betting on the compromise. Plus, as we are reminded in the previously on, Josh is still in the doghouse with the Democratic leadership after losing Carrick.
Right.
The conservative Democrat. And I remembered his name only, as stupid as it was at the time, only
Carrot
because
stick.
Of Carrot Stick.
It works. It's simple.
Yeah. So he gets sent out of the room. Leo says, the president has a full schedule tomorrow, Josh. Go make sure everybody knows he intends to keep it. I mean, it's just so rough. And you can see the sting of it on Josh's face.
I just wish he had asked him also to clean up the table.
We've got ghosts for that.
That's right.
Also, immediately after that moment...
You don't shoot a duck for quacking.
Are you speaking for the vice president?
Quacking thing kind of gives it away, doesn't it?
all of these lines are played off camera, and to me, somehow that makes them funnier.
Yeah, I also have to say, I was gulled by the clever little gambit there, thinking like, wow, that's some bad dialogue they wrote, the moment before I realized it was Will paraphrasing Bingo Bob. I thought like, wow, that's what Will's saying?
Right, you don't shoot a duck for quacking at first. Yeah. Seems like really bad, but then it pays off. Like,
oh, that makes sense, yeah.
It's great.
And that was a good payoff.
And I think by having the camera spin around that way to follow Josh on his way out and then CJ on her way in, it makes them throwaway lines. And by lowering the stakes of what those are, you know, not seeing them play out on camera, it lowers the stakes. And I think that ends up making them more effective.
Yeah, I agree.
Like on this show, if we were trying to tell jokes, it would be terrible. But in the service of talking about a...
Right. It's also terrible.
They're all throwaway.
Very
lines.
Good, very
by,
good point.
By making all of our discussion throwaway lines, we've elevated them.
Right. And I think also choosing to have the podcast take place entirely off camera.
Exactly.
Very good choice. I found another, if we can get back to the Gripe Fest, please.
Oh,
I found another instance of they would have gotten there sooner, similar to my reaction to Toby's and Joe's conversations about Ashland, the Chief Justice, and my feeling that the episode was kind of bloated with unnecessary scenes. I felt that way a little bit about the scene between Leo and President Bartlett while he's watching his basketball game. I felt like that's what would have happened immediately upon President Bartlett's exit from the mural room, from the Roosevelt room, rather. I just think that's where they would have gotten immediately. We got to talk about this.
But then we don't get a basketball metaphor.
Yeah, well, I guess that's, yeah, there you go. Was it worth it, ultimately?
We actually get two little giveaways from the game that the president's watching. Because he says, A, the thing that we talked about earlier, you know, they've got a 7-foot center and the best power forward in the game, Y zone. But then also he says,
the game is won or lost in the last 5 minutes.
Which also made me feel like, oh, okay, we'll find out at the end of the episode.
Well, now that you say it, I should have taken that as a warning and skipped to the last 5 minutes of the episode. I think actually President Bartlett is unintentionally criticizing the episode he's currently being featured in.
But it turns out he was wrong, because by the time they do finish, there's actually still 10 minutes left for him to get to dinner.
Ah,
they take 110 minutes. He has 2 hours before the state dinner.
Well done.
There's a nice moment that I thought said a lot in Leo's office. You know, we've heard that Halfley is on the cover of Time. And then in Leo's office, we actually see the magazine cover and it says, the new boss.
Quick turnaround. They got that cover out.
I mean, you know, everybody knows that Halfley is dictating terms, I think even before this. So
fair enough. They had it ready to go.
I think so, yeah. But so the Time cover says, the new boss. And then we see Leo turn it over. He turns it over and hides the cover as...
Right.
Bob Russell comes in.
I noticed that, sure.
And Bob Russell's trying to make demands and dictate what he thinks the direction should be, or at least weigh in. And despite Leo's own internal disagreement with the president, he's got to present a strong front. And I like the idea that just having this periodical in the room, just having this other thing that makes it seem like there's outside voices also questioning the president's leadership. Like, he needs to get rid of that in order to strengthen
his... Do what he has to do.
Yeah.
I agree. That is a nice touch. But here's one of my here's a question I have. Why is it so quickly upon the heels of this stalemate and the imminent shutdown? Why is it such a GOP win?
I hate November.
No. Christmas came early this year.
I mean, in part, I get that President Bartlett has abdicated the fight around optics. But, you know, Halfley, as you say, was already being perceived as dictating terms. Well, he didn't get what he wanted. He walked out of the room with the government shutdown.
Right.
Why is it such a win for Halfley and a loss for the administration?
Because they're confident they're going to get something that they want anyway. Like, they think that they're going to get 3%. They think that the president is backed into a corner. So no matter what, at some point, they're going to get the budget reduction, you know, the spending reductions that they want, because they just have the stronger hand. The president doesn't have the power to negotiate, Halfley thinks. And they can go and say, hey, look, we didn't even do this. The president, we offered him a deal. It was his decision to shut it down. So it's both his fault, and then eventually when this thing gets resolved, we're still going to get what we want.
No, I understand why the GOP Congress people in a room would feel that this is to their advantage, but it seems to be playing out publicly that way, instantaneously. Why isn't an incredible amount of pressure being applied to the Republican legislators who have tripled their demand at the last moment leading to a shutdown? Why is it just so generally accepted that it's, I mean, we've been in the room and so we know that President Bartlet, I guess, made that final decision, but why does this play out immediately in public as a GOP win? I guess what it seems to me is the reason it's playing out that way is because President Bartlet doesn't make any attempt to communicate with the public. CJ is sent out in the dark without a word from the president, and so they're just surrendering the optics of it all. I guess that's part of what I sort of found not credible, although I guess we're meant to take President Bartlet as, and there is a weird little interchange of dialogue when they say, you know, is something else going on? Almost as if they're wondering whether he is, you know, I felt like the unspoken thing was almost, is he suffering dementia? Is he unable to lead? Like, what is going on? Yeah. So I guess we're supposed to feel that this is an episode where, from the precipice of disaster, the president gets his shit together and starts governing again. But it just seems so totally, it's hard, as a hard buy for me that, you know, normally you would think the two sides would walk out of the room and immediately get to, how do we spin this in our favor? Look, those guys, we had a deal and those guys tripled their demands at the final moment. Obviously, we couldn't accept that. But, you know, they don't make any effort to do that. And hence, the optics are lost.
Well, I think it is this line that Josh has, which is that nobody understands the budget process and there's active confusion or lack of information about what the real ramifications of asking for an additional 2% are. Because they say, oh, we were going to reduce it by 1%. They wanted 3%. And rather than be able to compromise or find or give in to 3%, I think it's a win because people don't understand what the 2% difference is.
But do you believe Bartlet would let that happen without trying to mount some sort of education campaign to let the public know why this is an entirely unacceptable plan that the Republicans are offering?
But don't you think, I mean, that is what CJ tries to do in the press room.
Well, CJ tries to do it, but she does it without, you know, she does it with one scribbled figure on a legal pad. The president, the way he behaves, I don't buy. Mm. I'll be watching basketball.
Well, I think this would be a great time to take a look at how President Bill Clinton handled the situation in 1995. He had a much more hands-on approach to the shutdown. So let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll speak to Gene Sperling.
And now, back to the show.
Joining us now is Gene Sperling. He was the director of the National Economic Council under President Bill Clinton. He worked in the White House when the 1995 shutdown happened. And he was also the director of the National Economic Council under President Barack Obama in 2013 when that shutdown happened. In addition to that, he was an advisor on the West Wing, including when they wrote this episode. We really couldn't have gotten a better guest for this episode. Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Can you tell us how the idea for this episode first got introduced as far as your memory of it?
Well, what I remember was there was interest in doing this and, you know, they wanted to really understand what it was like, what had happened. And I had obviously lived through intimately the 1995-96 shutdown. And so, you know, a lot of it was going through in some detail, not just the details that happened, but, you know, what was the feeling? What was the basic conflicts that you were facing? You've got a White House and a president who are in charge, but are dealing with the fact that their popularity is fading, that Republicans control Congress, and they're facing that conflict of, on one hand, they don't want to fight a losing battle and get more out of touch with the public. On the other hand, they got to get their mojo back. They got to look for that opportunity to turn it around and show what they're fighting for. And that's playing out in this very unpredictable situation of a budget showdown.
Hmm. In terms of the mechanics of getting your input on this episode, how did that work? Did you get a call?
There were times where I worked there where they really wanted your complete download. What did the pizza boxes, et cetera, look like? Huh. Here, I think you really are downloading everything. There's not that much written about this. There's not that much authoritative. So you're really trying to bring them into the West Wing. Now, I think one of the things that they were very interested in was the unknowns when you go into a shutdown. that in 1995, when the government shut down, we did not really know how it would work out. It wasn't really a plan. And when you go into the shutdown, one of the big issues, which is portrayed in the show, is who's going to be blamed. Now, we were probably in the real White House more focused on that long before. I think we had long set up that Gingrich was the one who was making extreme demands. And you're also trying to set up, if there's a shutdown, why is there a shutdown? Whose side are you on? So in our case, we were very much positioning the truth, which was we were defending the Great Society. We were trying to set up that when a shutdown came, that one, it was their fault. They were the ones being unreasonable. And number two, if people were trying to figure out why is this happening, they would think we were on the side of them, that we were sticking up for their Medicare, their Medicaid, their education. In the real shutdown that happened in 95, it was much more portrayed that Gingrich was very nervous when the shutdown happened, that he had told his guys that Clinton would blink and that at a minimum he would get Clinton to agree to block granting Medicaid. When Clinton takes this very strong, almost like movie-like position that that's not going to happen, and Gingrich goes out to the microphone, he's shaken. And he, in some ways, never quite recovers for the rest of his speakership from judging Clinton wrong, from not having a plan B if Clinton didn't go along. In this one, they kind of switch it around. They have Halfley going to the mic in front of the White House more confident that they're winning. And you see the Bartlett White House more fearful that things are not going well. And they're quite passive for a long time in this episode, right? They're just kind of, what's the matter with the president? Is he out of touch? Doesn't he see the public's against us? We're losing. Things are going to get worse. And they're not doing much during that episode other than trying to convince Bartlett that he's taking an unreasonable position.
This was Josh's biggest issue with the episode, actually.
That's right. I was going to say, in 95, you describe a situation where they are playing long ball and sort of trying to frame the optics of it before the decision's even made. So I wonder, is it really credible for a president like Bartlett to make the snap decision at the moment not to take the 3% that will go into shutdown and then to walk out and refuse to even discuss with his staff how they're going to move forward?
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, rewatching the episode, I thought that was the worst part of it, was the implication that they would just be passive. When you're fighting so hard, you would have wanted to show them more, trying to define the message and shaping it every single day, instead of just looking at the news and wondering who's getting blamed because the Washington Monument is getting shut down. Now, I think what they tried to do is, instead of doing that strategic type of more realistic, I think, strategery, instead, people got very enamored, and I was part of the conversation on deciding that what if you showed Bartlett walking down to the Capitol? Now, that was, in a sense, a dramatic portrayal of showing the president as the one who is trying to get a deal. And when they make the mistake in the show of not, of the speaker makes the mistake of not receiving him, Josh is kind of on his game and says, let's leave. So, you know, in a sense, you could see that as a dramatic stunt that kind of shows President Bartlett as the one trying to get the deal. But even then, it was without kind of the message content of who they were fighting for. So I really agree. I think it would have been a more realistic and a more interesting show to have seen it.
Can you tell us about the Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich dynamic when they were face to face? You know, at the end of this episode, you have the president and the speaker in the Oval Office. And for 2 hours, you know, they sit down and they really hammer it out. But there's also some really fiery exchanges between them before they get to that resolution.
Who are trapped in a failed system. I can't stand by.
I'm not going to negotiate with anyone who holds a gun to my head.
What was the interpersonal dynamic like between Clinton and Gingrich?
Well, it was an interesting interpersonal dynamic. You know, Gingrich very much wanted to take down President Clinton, but he also wanted his respect. He wanted Clinton to see him as a smart policy wonk in the way Clinton was. And it was common for the two of them to launch off on a rather arcane policy issue. But I think if someone's looking for a moment where a specific sentence or line is taken from real life and put in the show, it is when Bartlett says to Halfley in the Oval,
"I don't care if my approval ratings drop into single digits. I am the president."
That comes from the actual meeting in the cabinet room on the evening of November 13th. Clinton kind of responds, "I'm never going to do your budget. I'm never going to do your Medicaid cuts. I don't care if it all comes down around me. I don't care if I go to 5% in the polls. I'm never going to sign your budget." Bill Clinton, whose mother had been a nurse in rural Arkansas, knew what healthcare meant for poor people and was saying, you know, you've pushed too far. No way. And that breaks Gingrich. Gingrich has told his team that Clinton will fold in the end. He thinks that he's got intel to suggest he would go with that. And when Clinton does that, Gingrich walks out, and if you watch the tapes of him when he leaves the White House, he's shaken. He never really has a plan B. So in this context, it's not in the cabinet room. It's not with everyone. But you've now seen that Halfley has made a strategic blunder by not meeting with Bartlett when he comes up to the Hill. He's feeling a little weaker, and you do see Bartlett look at him and say, "I don't care if," he doesn't say 5%, but he says, "I don't care if my popularity goes to single digits." And I think that that was, in a sense, perhaps supposed to reflect that moment where Halfley, as with Gingrich, realizes they judged wrong. This guy isn't going to be just completely political. He's got a principled backbone, and now you better reevaluate.
One of the things that Josh and I discussed about the president's position when he makes that argument in the show is that he's not going to be facing re-election. He's in his second term already, but that wasn't the case in the real version of this in 1995.
Much bolder for President Clinton to take that tack.
Yeah.
You know, at this moment, I don't think most people, including us, think we're going to be re-elected. I mean, the 1994 congressional election, you know, was a public humiliation. It was President Clinton loses his signature domestic program for universal health care. He's then painted as, you know, a big spending socialist Democrat. He's rejected in the polls. Gingrich is seen by many as the most powerful person in D.C. And they're steamrolling us. And so this moment turns out to be in many ways the pivotal moment in the Clinton presidency, but it goes to what Josh says might have been the weakness in the show. What makes it strong for Clinton, what turns him around, is not just that he was better tactically in the shutdown, but that he got the policy back on his side by saying he was for a balanced budget over a longer period of time, et cetera, by neutralizing that. He made the issue, who is going to be the defender of your health care, of your education, of the environment? And so it was used in a much more significant way. And the perception of him changed a lot in the public as that this guy was going to be a defender, a check on powers.
Well, one thing I noticed, if I'm not wrong, I think, as you would expect, most of the time when we get to the point of government shutdown, it's because we've got an executive office inhabited by one party and a Congress of the other. Am I wrong at that? Under Jimmy Carter, there were multiple shutdowns when the Democrats were in both had the presidency and Congress?
No, you really haven't had, there really wasn't anything like really the 1995 or 96. I mean, this shuts down not just for a day, it shuts down for 5-6 days, and then it shuts down for an additional 26, 27 days. I think this is a exceptional moment at the time. You know, in 2013, the politics end up being much tougher. When they go into shutdown, the public kind of blames both the Republicans and President Obama equally. We did not know what would happen in 1995. I have to tell one story because it's too priceless. So in the middle of the government shutdown in 2013, or perhaps it was right as on the edge of the negotiations of the shutdown in 2011, it was 2011, we hadn't quite shut down yet, but we're sitting in the Oval, and we're a bit surprised and shocked that the president has called Speaker Boehner and he hasn't returned his call. And, you know, he's kind of asking Jack, Lou, and myself, you guys have been around for a long time, have you seen this? And he said, no, it's very unusual for somebody not to return the president's call, no matter how upset they are. And the president kind of sitting in his chair in the Oval says, you know, what the hell? I should just be like Bartlett. Just walk down there.
It's so great that he had the scene, you know, ready, ready to deploy in that moment.
Absolutely. I mean, just out of nowhere. I should be like Bartlett, just walk on down there and knock on his door. So, yeah, that was the ultimate life imitating art, imitating life moment for me.
That's really good.
That's fantastic.
I wanted to wrap up by asking you one last question that might be a little bit controversial and also might be a little bit unfair, but I'll leave it to you to decide. So last time when you spoke to us for season 4, we talked about how in the West Wing, there was kind of with the Kundanese, kind of a rewriting of what happened in the Clinton administration with Rwanda. And in the West Wing, you know, there's sort of a chance to take inspiration from that and kind of do it right. Where, as you said, you know, the Clinton administration had a lot of regrets about how that all went down. Here, the story that you've told and the way that this all happened with the shutdown in 95, President Clinton really had kind of a heroic moment here. Whereas, as Josh has pointed out in our discussion very poignantly, how President Bartlett was kind of doing nothing. You know, he was just sitting there and it took Josh really to make anything happen. Okay, so here's my question. Who do you think is a better president, President Bartlett or President Clinton?
You know, geez, I think that's like comparing Muhammad Ali to Jack Johnson. I mean, the interesting thing that you could say about Bartlett was you could say that episode perhaps was more predictive of the next shutdown. Because in the next shutdown, Obama tries to, in a sense, go through the types of negotiations Clinton does and comes to the opinion eventually that because they're threatening to default the government, that he just can't anymore. That after he goes through the first in 2011, and then he tells all of us, that's it. I can't do this to the office of the presidency. You are not going to put a gun to the president or to the country's finances, to their head. We can fight all sorts of different ways, but you can't do that. So maybe President Bartlett wasn't fighting the past war as well as Bill Clinton did. But maybe there was something prophetic about the way presidents perhaps were going to have to be going forward with an even more unreasonable Republican Congress.
Very diplomatic.
Good answer. Well threaded.
Gene, thank you so much for joining us again. And
another great interview.
Incredible stories.
Thanks. It's extraordinary for me to talk about this episode because it does bring you to three, you know, very important parts of one's life.
I'm so happy that you're able to join us.
It's special for us to have access to somebody like you who was there in the room. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
So there's one other part that we haven't talked about yet, which is Abby's return. Leo, by the way, also gets in on the poker metaphor later when he says to the president, "You're putting all our chips down on a single hand. We can't win." But then he decides he has to make a call, and he calls in Abby like Batman with match jewelry.
True. Yes, she gets quite the hero entrance.
It's actually kind of a little bit like John Goodman's entrance when we first see him, you know, coming into the White House shrouded in darkness and then walking through the halls. And we kind of, you know,
that's true.
Look who's coming to dinner, to the state dinner.
That said, what about Abby's reappearance unlocks things for the president, or what does she bring to the table? What does she bring to this particular situation?
Well, so Leo thinks that Abby is going to bolster his arguments to get the president to listen to reason and cave to Halfley's demands, but he miscalculates that. Instead, Abby asks the president a crucial question.
Chad, where's Josh?
Mm-hmm.
Question I often ask myself 10 minutes before we're about to record a podcast. It is a crucial question. And by asking that, you know, it gives a chance for the president to kind of reassess what's actually happening in his own war room and remember that he has the best power forward in the game. And so he calls him in. And by the way, I love it. Okay, now another, I'm going to mix sports metaphors. That moment when Josh gets called back up to the majors. Mm-hmm. I love, he's so ready for it.
He's ready for it, yes.
The combination of Abby getting called in and walking into the building and then Josh getting the call, this feels like the nerdiest version of Ocean's 11. or Fast and Furious, you know, we're getting a team together.
Right.
To pass a budget. I love this, by the way, the most explicit sort of callback to CJ's figuring it out in the past.
Toby, we've all been assuming this is the president not understanding what's really going on. He's been so out of it since Zoe, you know. We've all been protecting him. You, me, Leo. What if it's something else?
It's not.
But what if it is?
Okay, it's something else. Like what?
Leadership.
Mm. And it does remind me of that moment of when CJ recognizes what the 22 caliber comment really was.
Right.
And it also reminds me of the CJ and Toby conversation about Uncle Fluffy versus the president, you know, in the last debate for the last job he'll ever have. You know, if he's going to show up, it'll be a sight to see. So again, this is a song. I love this song, but I've also feel like I've heard the song before. Also, not an explicit callback, but just going again with some basketball metaphors here. What I thought of when he tells the president to walk up to the speaker's office, but then especially when he tells him to leave and you see all those cameras there, I thought Josh is telling the president to throw an elbow on a nationally televised game.
Hmm. Ah, well put. Yeah.
But that moment also when they're in front of the National Archives.
The Capitol's just a 5 or 10 minute walk from here. Care to stretch your legs?
I'm sorry, folks. I've got a meeting on the Hill.
The president has this grin, like a grin breaks out on his face in a way that I feel like he sees what they're going to do. And the recognition, I think, you know, he's got an ally who's on his side, who's seeing it the way that he's going to see it. That moment from Martin Sheen is so great. And also, I love how Angela Blake is surprised and, you know, seems clearly impressed with Josh's moves.
This is the first time in a while you and I have been significantly on different pages in response to an episode.
That's true. Yeah, I can't disagree with any of your objections, though. I just, in the moment of watching the episode, I watched it twice. I enjoyed it, but I think that all of your nitpicks are, or not even nitpicks, I think your gripes are...
Some of them are nitpicky. I mean, to me, it was, I think, the accretion of small, mishandled details that led to a feeling that I wanted to watch the better version of this episode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even the little girl, this is really bad. This is a real nitpick.
Oh, on the TV?
The little girl, yeah, that we see, and she's like, I wanted to go see the Smithsonian and Grandma. Now the Smithsonian is closed, and I only get to see Grandma. I was like, she's bad. I mean, sorry, I hate to point out bad acting. I even find something nice to say about Brad now and again. But
Brad acting.
Brad acting. Now that's some Brad acting. I thought she was bad and it was clunky. It just didn't feel like an actual moment on the news. A person, you know, a little kid doing an interview. It felt like a little actress doing badly.
Sorry.
Doing Bradley.
Sorry, young lady.
Doing Bradley.
You know what is a great moment of Brad acting, though? Is just another entry in the Brad Museum of weird Josh celebrations. Just to jump
right
to the end when the president says, we have a budget, and he says,
I had to shower immediately after hearing that.
Okay, there's another moment that I liked for its echoes of past episodes when CJ is telling the press about the homemade state dinner they're going to have. And she says, in addition to the well-dressed bird, not to be confused with Flamingo herself, she says the Bartletts will also be serving their guests a Colorado beet salad and California green beans. And so I thought, shout out to Galileo. The president is eating green beans, although not Oregon green beans. So f*** you, Oregon.
That's good. Yeah, there's something in my mind wanted to make that connection, but I couldn't quite do it. I knew there was something there.
So in the final scene between the president and Halfley,
where they teach each other about the basic tenets of liberalism versus conservatism. Yeah, it was it was a little rough. I'm like, ooh, Schoolhouse Rock in this final, in this ultimate head-to-head. I don't buy it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's nice to know that some people are for smaller government.
Aye, aye, aye.
But I did really like the final volley from the president in this exchange where he says,
stand by. I'm not going to negotiate with anyone who holds a gun to my head. We had a deal.
I don't care if my approval ratings drop into single digits. I am the president of the United States, and I will lead this government shutdown until we reach an equitable agreement.
And I thought, just in that last, those last few lines of the scene, the president does a lot of things in very few sentences. He starts by saying, you know, well, I'm not going to negotiate with anyone who holds a gun to my head. And I think it reiterates his position while also subtly framing Halfley as a terrorist, and they don't negotiate with terrorists. And then he says, you know, we had a deal. So, you know, now he's making his direct confrontation about, oh, this guy went against his word to his face, maybe trying to appeal to a sense of honor. And then he finally reveals his hand, where he says, I don't care if my approval ratings drop to single digits, and I will leave the government shut down. And those are stakes that Halfley just can't afford.
Yes, it's actually, it's interesting. All of a sudden, there's a certain leverage to be utilized in being a lame duck.
Yeah, exactly.
He's going, I don't really care about my legacy. You probably have more elections to run. So
yeah,
let's do this.
Yeah. So I felt like that was really nice writing, that they could do all of that in just a few sentences.
I agree. Good save.
And that's the end of the exchange. You know, the next thing we hear is that they've come to an agreement.
Right.
In a neat twist in this episode, Josh invokes a basketball metaphor to tell Donna that she's like the rookie who pulled down one rebound alongside Wilt Chamberlain, which reminded me of you when he said, the rookie said it was the proudest day of his life. Together, he and Wilt went for 34 points and 56 rebounds.
Reminded me. I thought the same thing too. That's my Alice and Janney joke. Between us, she and I have won 7 Emmys. That's funny. I thought the exact same thing. Like, maybe that's where I got the idea. I don't think so.
It's a good joke nonetheless.
Maybe that's where they got the idea.
Exactly.
So Donna's miracle pull is about the
Social Security.
Social Security, that the checks aren't going to go out?
She, you know, on the not laptop that's full of not porn or whatever, when she's compiling all of the departments that are being affected, she includes Social Security.
Why'd you put Social Security on the list? It's an entitlement.
Yeah, but we sent home the people from the Social Security Administration who run the machines that cut the checks.
Checks won't go out.
Right. And yeah, because Josh is asking her to count up all of the programs affected by the shutdown. And I think this is one of the pieces of ammo that they can use in both their negotiations as well as in the public fight.
I guess I just wondered about that little subplot, how they would have been caught off guard about that particular point, there having been government shuts down before, going back to Reagan. So how would they not have caught this on their own? How would they not have been entirely ready for this?
There was no Reagan in the West Wing universe.
Fair enough. There was no anybody.
Right.
I mean, they certainly didn't establish that this has never happened before. This is the first government shutdown. So yeah. I don't know why they need Donna to catch something that humongous.
Well, I mean, I guess we should say it's not that there wasn't anybody. There was Seward, at least. There was Aaron Burr. There was Seward. There was the interview at Weehawken. We know about Aaron Burr. I mean, again, I think that the greater point here is that Donna continues her sort of path of being a hero. She's done really well with Angela Blake. She's a person who knows the documents inside and out. And it's just reinforcing this idea that Donna really, she goes above and beyond the scope of her position.
You were really willing to overlook a lot in order to enjoy this episode.
I guess I was. I didn't know that I was overlooking it.
That's good. Yay. We're getting back to the old days when I would try to ruin an episode for you. Also, I remember now when I first got that moment about don't take my laptop, I thought there might have been billet doux, if that is the correct phrase for love letters. That the idea was maybe there was something Josh and Donna related on the laptop.
I thought Josh has been writing fanfic about himself and Donna.
Or a love letter he never sent is more. Get your mind out of the gutter.
He's on the message boards on Lemon Lyman saying, here's my new
entirely
idea.
Possible. That wraps it up for this episode of the West Wing Weekly. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Margaret Miller and Zach McNeese.
Thanks to our guest, Gene Sperling. You can follow Gene Sperling on Twitter at Gene B. Sperling. And you can follow us at West Wing Weekly. We're also on Facebook and on Instagram. We have a website. It's called thewestwingweekly.com. I guess it would be weird if this were the first episode you ever heard, and therefore this was the first time you ever got this information, but I'm saying it anyway.
Right. You can buy stuff at thewestwingweekly.com/merch, or you could cut out the middleman and just send us your money for creating this wonderful podcast by going to westwingweekly.com/merch. donate. Is that right?
That's right, actually. I forgot that people could do that. I thought you were making a joke.
We'll take cold hard cash. But that, come on.
That was real.
Giving it to you for nothing.
Oh, it's too bad. I was really just, I was picturing...
I say I would recommend...
With quarters in them.
I would recommend a donation of $5 per episode you've listened to. That seems fair. Remember, I only get $2.50.
Well, thanks so much for listening. Quarters or no. We've been your ghosts.
See you next time.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.